Meeting of the Tax Reform Division on Thursday, April 4th, 2013. We have in the packets, your folders, the minutes from Thursday, March 21st. Are there any corrections? Seeing none, Senator Dietzick moves approval of the minutes from Thursday, March 21st. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails and minutes are approved. First bill on our agenda this morning is Senator Lori, who brings us Senate File 1053 with regard to Moose Lake. Welcome to the committee, Senator Lori. We're pleased to have you here.
I'm pleased to be back. We're here yesterday morning as well.
Regular trips to the tax committee.
I'm well caffeinated and got a little bit of sleep. But glad to be back. And we have Senate File 1053, Moose Lake local option sales tax before you. We have several individuals who have driven down from Moose Lake to help. So I'll just step through the nuts and bolts. And I know that the committee is very familiar with this type of proposal. So I'll step through it rather quickly. It authorizes the City of Moose Lake to impose a sales and use tax of up to 0.5%. It's important to note that this was approved in a voter referendum in November of 2012 by about a 2-to-1 margin. It is well supported within the community. It requires that the revenue from the tax be used for improvements to the city park system, streets and related infrastructure improvements, and municipal library improvements, and to pay for the administering the tax collections. It also authorizes the city to issue bonds of up to $3 million to finance those projects. And it's important to note that Moose Lake is a city of very regional significance, and these parks are trailheads for the entire Willard-Munger trail system that goes all the way from Duluth to the Twin Cities and is used by the entire state as a really valuable resource. The tax expires 20 years after the tax is first imposed or when the City Council determines that the $3 million has been received to pay for the bonds that would be used to do these necessary improvements. And that's really the nuts and bolts of the bill. With that, I'll turn it over to Mayor Ted Shaw to start with the testimony.
Mayor Shaw, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Yeah, Theodore Bruce Shaw, Mayor of Moose Lake. Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. Before I speak about the three areas, I'd like to show a picture of Moose Lake, a layout, which kind of explains our tax base, and I feel it's very pertinent before we start.
Sure. Yeah.
Speak loudly.
This is the layout of Moose Lake, the city right here. Right here is the two state facilities, SOP and BOC. Now, within the city limits of Moose Lake, 75% of the land is tax exempt. 50% of that tax exempt land is all state owned. Stretches all the way across here. The other 25% is the local school, our parks, the churches, and that makes up the other 25%. So that leaves the tax base left is the 25% of the city of Moose Lake, two houses here. And just to get that understanding of how the city of Moose Lake tax structure is set.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so you're looking at the city geographic there, and if you had a city street that goes by those state facilities that you would have a sewer and water assessment on, would those facilities pay that?
We did, in fact, put up a new collection system in just the last few years at a cost of a couple, well, it was about $1.5 million up to the facility, and it was stubbed off and not used because MSOP canceled their portion of the project that would have hooked up to that sewer line.
So, Madam Chair, you were putting in a storm sewer or storm collection, stormwater collection.
It was
line,
a sewer.
Sewer line. Up,
yes.
And it was going to MSOP.
Correct.
What's that?
Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Okay, thank you. And they decided not to participate. Did it go by one of the state facilities, and did they participate and pay the assessment?
No, the DOC, which has been there for a number of years, used to be the state hospital. They are using an old clay line, actually, that goes south and hooks up to our system in another place. And that old clay line is probably 60, 70 years old, put in back in the 1930s when the state hospital was built.
So they're really not participating in any of the infrastructure?
They did not hook up to that. Either was built for the MSOP. When we first started that project, we had to do a 20-year projected look at all the participating. That'd be we have a sewer district with the city and the MSOP and DOC, so we asked for their expansion, what their capacity would be in 20 years. That led to the development of the project, which we submitted to the state, which was approved, and we went out for the funding, and that was approved, and we started the project. And when we did finish the collection system, but it was never, no one hooked up to it. But it is right there.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Scoyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we're a little off subject here, but I appreciate the information. I am doing some other work with regard to state buildings and special assessments, and thank you for the information.
Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair and Senator Scoyer, you're actually, a little off this topic and onto a pretty sore topic, because I was at the meetings where the 20-year projections were given to the city and where we worked out, you know, what our infrastructure needs would be and set plans in place, and then had those projections not come about and are left in a really tough spot. But that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to build infrastructure to support the regional significance of the city of Moose Lake, to continue to support the region and make this trailhead accessible and usable for all the city and the thousands of tourists that and vacationers that come and enjoy our woods and lakes and streams.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Lurie, and to the Moose Lake folks, I'll probably draw upon your experiences later on this session.
Good.
Thank you. Just for information, MSOP does go through the sewer does go through the DOC to that old clay line, and that's how they're hooked up to the city system. Thank you. I'm going on to the three areas that the citizens of Moose Lake passed the sales tax local referendum for us. We have it was the street systems, related streets and related infrastructure, improvements to the city park systems that would benefit area residents and regional tourism, including the Earl Ellens Park Riverside Arena project and the historic Trail Depot project. The third one is the municipal library improvements. On page 3 of the handout we sent you, we start the kind of a little bit of talking points on each of those items. The city of Moose Lake has approximately 25 miles of streets. The trail system and the trail system and 6 city-owned parks are the second item, and the Moose Lake Public Library. Of those 25 miles of city streets, which are in poor condition, I put down here that it was 20 years ago that most of them haven't repaired, but talking to the director of our streets, some of them go back 50 years. We don't have records of when they were last repaired besides the patching. It goes on annually. So I put down 20 because I couldn't prove past that that none of them have been repaired past that time. So annually, for the past 20 years, we've been patching streets. And as most you probably know from your own communities, a patch will last so many months and there's a big hole again, and it's annually, constant repair. In the last couple of years, we did repair about 5 miles, 4 to 5 miles of streets. And that was really the first time that those streets had been repaired for many, many years. It got to the point where we had to do something with them, so we started projects, kind of cut a lot of things that we normally wouldn't cut to fund those projects, but we had to start. It just was a point where we couldn't go on with the patching. In fact, the engineers city engineer that we had, LHB, at the time in Duluth, said, you can't patch these roads anymore. They're past the point. This has to be tore up and redone from the base. And a lot of that is, since we are a rural regional area, and we're different from most areas, and we're thankful for the state facilities because we have more people coming into the city every day than leaving, which is unusual for a small community. Usually it's the other way. They leave to go to work. But the way the city is, because of the state facilities and the school and the hospital we have more people coming in than going out. Our population does say we have 2,700, but 1,500 of those are incarcerated. So the incarcerated numbers are larger than the actual city population. So it does bring in those jobs, and for those we are very thankful for. If we move on to the parks and trails, as Senator Laurie stated, we are a trailhead. We have about 5 to 6 trails that meet right in Moose Lake: the Munger Trail, the Sioux Trail. We have a number of snowmobile trails and a bike trail, and very highly used, very popular. And a lot of events that happen because of that trail system. And they do kind of connect up with our arena that we have that unfortunately flooded this last year with a flood. But that's another problem for the city. Moving on to the public library, because we are a regional, kind of a rural regional center, our library is very highly used. On an average, we have about 55,000 activity events that happen. You know, in other words, a person is in there to take a book out, use the computers, periodicals, whatever. So the count is very high for it, and it's unusual for a small library to have that many, but it is average on a year about 55,000 activities from patrons using that facility. Before the two state facilities, their population were counted. In other words, if a city at about 1,300 people, and we're still averaging 54,000 to 55,000 activities, that was stated. It was the seventh busiest library in the nation for that population size. But when the DOC and MSFP population were counted within the city limit, even though they don't use the library, that dropped the library status way down because then the numbers are skewed. We did make an agreement with Arrowhead Library System that DOC goes directly to the Arrowhead Library System because with their population incarcerated of 1,000 and some people, we could not handle that large amount of activity, and the same with MSOP. We have 5 part-time employees. 2 are on each day. If we had to add the 1,500 incarcerated person, it would overwhelm the system. We wouldn't be able to handle it. in Moose Lake. So luckily Arrowhead system is taking care of DOC at this time, but MSLP does not have, I believe, access to the library system in Moose Lake or the Arrowhead. And they've been asking us almost monthly when we could use, they could use a system, and we have to continue to tell them, no, we just don't have the staff to handle. I think MSOP has a population around 550, I think, incarcerated.
And Adam, these guys have a lot of time to read.
So regionally, we already have a huge influx from the whole regional area using the library, and we're afraid it just overwhelm us too much.
Senator Lori, we do have a number of bills dealing with local option sales taxes, so we are going to have to move on. But Senator Skoy, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. And are you a signatory of a regional library system?
Arrowhead Regional System.
So you're part of the regional?
Yes, we are.
And so they're helpful on your
yes.
library then?
Thank yes, you. We are.
Senator Lori, could we hear from your other testifier there at this point?
Tom Paul is the flood manager from the city of Moose Lake.
Madam Chair,
Paul.
Senators,
welcome
thank you.
To
my
the
name
committee.
Is my name is Tom Paul. I was hired by the city of Moose Lake to try to figure out all of the damage working with FEMA on the public infrastructure side. Moose Lake is, I know every city that comes here probably says that they're unique and individual, but Moose Lake really is kind of a strange place when you look at the tax base and population. Actually, there are 1,650 of the 2,700 people are actually institutionalized when you talk between the two facilities. You also talk about nursing homes and other care facilities. So there's 1,100 people and 650 approximately households that have to pay for 100% of everything that happens in the city. We have a hockey program that is a fairly good hockey program, and the number sounds like it doesn't make sense, but we actually cover 2,000 square miles of kids that come to play hockey in Moose Lake. We cover 6 school districts for our area hockey program, and we also had 4 feet of water that was in the hockey rink this year. I would like to say thank you to MSOP and DOC. DOC, the CIP, Correction Incentive Program, had some of their inmates there for I'm not sure how many hours, and honestly, if they didn't do the work that they did this year, we would not have had a hockey season this year. So the state was great in helping that out. But now we're looking at a point where we really need a new facility and how to provide funding for it, and this would be one excellent way to try to find an additional funding source through the sales tax. As far as you talk about the trails, we did sustain some damage to the trails, which will be paid for. At this point, our city engineer, we're estimating about $1.7 million of damage to the city infrastructure. FEMA's at about $1.3 million. So we're $400,000 to $500,000 apart that we're still working through. So what we really want to do is we want to make sure that we have a good trail system. I can actually leave from my house and go anywhere in the state on a snowmobile, which is pretty impressive. And I think that's why it's a huge draw. You know, so we want to make sure that we can maintain that high level of access from the city of Moose Lake for the trails, for hockey, for recreation, and to have the library system, too. The closest library is in Cloquet, so you're talking 30 miles away. So we really draw from a large area.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Paul. Are there any questions for Senator Lori, Mayor Shaw, or Mr. Paul? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen, for
thank
being
you.
Here,
thank
and
you, Madam
we will
Chair,
lay
members.
Over Senate File 1053. Next on our agenda is Senate File 1116, dealing with City of Marshall. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dames, Senator Dames, and we're welcome your presentation of Senate File 1116.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Senator Gary Dames, and today I have with me Ben Martag, the City Administrator of Marshall, and John D. Kramer, excuse me, the one of the city council members from the city of Marshall.
Terrific.
I am here today to present Senate File 1116. Senate File 1116 is more of a technical bill in nature. As I recall, back in 2010, the bill was approved for the city of Marshall for the sales tax on food and lodging and beverage. And in 2011, there was an extension or an amendment to that bill to extend it. However, in the process of that happening, we failed to extend the date of filing time for the Secretary of State. So what this bill does is it is technical in nature. The first two sections deal with the usage of the funding, and then the third section deals with the filing dates. The filing date to the Secretary of State now would be June 15th of 2013, and the tax imposition for the City of Marshall to start authorizing or collecting these taxes would be July 1st of 2013. So with that said, I will turn it over to our two testifiers. First, Ben Martag, the City Administrator. Ben.
Welcome to the committee. If you could keep your remarks brief, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As our attorneys look to implement, work with us on the imposition of the law, we did look at it and felt there was some ambiguity on that. And since we'll be issuing debt for the project, we wanted to remove any and all areas of concerns for potential investors. Because even in working with your advisor's office, there is some question on whether or not, in fact, we do have the authority already, but felt it was just wanted to clarify
so
that.
So this is clarification language, Senator
right.
Dames?
Okay.
Yeah, that is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay.
So with that, we certainly would appreciate your support with this.
Council Member DeKramer, if you would like to say a few words as well.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I guess really what's been said, just to reiterate, this is some significant financing for the community, and we would just like to make sure that everything is properly taken care of, and we are moving ahead on this project and charging ahead, but make sure that we're doing it correctly. So thank you.
Thank you, Council Member. Anything else, Senator Dames?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just that this is a clarification and technical bill, and we would appreciate your support. And thank you for allowing us to bring the bill in front of your committee today.
Sure. Any questions for Senator Dames? Seeing none, we will lay over Senate File 1116. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being
thank
here
you, Madam
this
Chair.
Morning. The next bill on our list is Senate File 1207. Welcome to the committee, Senator. I think this is your first time here.
That is correct, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
We're pleased to have you, Senator Weber.
Senator Bill Weber, for the record, and I'm pleased to be in front of the committee this morning to present Senate File 1207. There's also an author's amendment. That you have?
There's an author's amendment. We'll distribute that right now.
Very good. And essentially, the amendment basically delineates the actual amount of bond authorization that is being requested by the...
Let's get that on the bill right away. Senator Eaton moves the A1 amendment.
Thank you.
Everybody have it? Just wait 1 second.
What does it do?
Okay. Senator Weber, do you have a copy of it as well?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Senator Eaton moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, this bill gives the City of Windham authorization to impose sales and excise taxes for projects that they are going to be pursuing, primarily a arena in their community. And at this point in time, we recognize that we're actually asking for permission from the legislature prior to the authorizing vote by the voters of Windham. However, it is their goal to have construction occur during the construction season of 2015. In the next general election is November of 14, and in order to, after if this is approved by the voters at that time, they can then go forward in confidence and spend the money for architects' plans, engineering reports, and that type of thing. And otherwise, if they need to wait till the end of the legislative session in 2015, then we always run the chance of not really getting the facility up in time for the ensuing season in the fall. And at this point in time, they have requested to raise $4 million proceeds from this tax. And then at that point, it would end within 15 years or within at a time when the council has determined that there is sufficient money to make all payments for the bonds. At this point in time, I am pleased to have with me today at the table right now Dominic Jones, council member from Windham, and Justin Espenson of the Building Committee. At this point, I will turn it over to council member Jones.
Welcome to the committee, council member Jones. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dominic Jones, City Council member, City of Windham, and resident for the past 20 years in the City of Windham. Thank you, Senator Weber, and fellow senators for hearing us today. When the City Council 2 years ago started a procedure of looking at our long-range planning to identify the needs of the community, we had many ideas come forward, and not just from the City Council. We had many public meetings with public input. From those meetings, it was decisive that we needed to look at some of our facilities within our city, good financial responsibility of being part of that. And it was identified that some of our infrastructure, our streets, our public facilities, such as an ice arena, possibly a fire hall, needed attention. So through the planning process, we came up with our list of items, and that our street project, we have actually just recently authorized the bonds for about $4.5 million as part of some of our street projects. We need the our opinion is that this sales tax can be a regional approach for the facilities that we talk about today, and that being fire hall, multi-purpose center such as an ice arena. It is our intent, once again, to use this as a regional approach. And our public has helped us define these projects, and we'd like to be able to place that back in front of our voters and let them decide on the project and hopefully author that. It is, as Senator Weber mentioned, our intent to put that on the 2014 ballot so we can, and this would provide us the opportunity to go forward and with the planning process, that we could be assured that we would have that authority. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Council Member Jones. Next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee, as well as Senator Webb for sponsoring the bill and bringing it forward today. My name is Justin Espenson. I am the chairman of our Arena Building Committee, which is made up of the following user groups: Windham Youth Hockey, Figure Skating, Racquetball, 4-H, Youth Baseball, numerous horse shows, dances, broom ball, Cottonwood County Fair, Youth Basketball, as well as several others. I am also a board member for the Windham Youth Hockey Association, as well as a small business owner living in Windham. I was born and raised in the Windham area and have been involved in our youth hockey program, whether coaching or playing, for over 30 years. I was fortunate enough to start playing hockey at age 4 and have seen firsthand the life skills that are developed from organized sports, and I'm committed to doing everything that I can to ensure that those same opportunities are available to the children in our community. On behalf of the user groups that I've listed above and that I represent, I am in favor of a local option sales tax to help fund upgrading facilities in Windham, Minnesota. As I have met with several local business owners as well as community members, there is great enthusiasm around the potential for upgrading these facilities. A majority of the community members that I have talked to have told me that they see upgrading facilities like ours as a key to keeping small rural towns vibrant and growing. As we have talked about the potential for a sales tax for funding, the most common response that I have received is, neighboring communities have a sales tax. Why don't we? What we are requesting is the opportunity to put it to our taxpayers to a vote. Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee, and Mr. Weber. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Weber or his testifier, Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, the bill is saying up to 1%. Can you guys clarify what you're thinking you're going to do and perhaps be more specific there?
Senator Weber?
At this point in time, I don't know if they've actually made a final determination on the 1%, but I would refer to the council member, or we have also a city administrator, Steve Nasby, here from Wyndham as well.
Council member Jones?
Madam Chair, the up to 1% is really trying to be fiscally responsible of only utilizing at the time that this is introduced to our public as a referendum vote, is to provide them with the numbers, whether it be half a cent, three quarters. If we don't need the money, we're not going to ask for it. So it is our intent to have that option up to 1%. As such, as stated, Mr. Nasby has maybe numbers, if it's associated with that, our city administrator. Thank you.
So Senator Wimmer and Council Member Jones, what's the question on the ballot going to be?
The question on the ballot would be to provide for the funding of up to $4 million. That's what our resolution from City Council stated.
Will the question read, shall a sales tax of
0.5%.
So on the ballot, it's not going to read up to.
No, I think
that's what.
That's
what
a clarification. It will be.
That makes us a little nervous.
Understand. Thank you.
We might ask you to state something specifically, even for this bill this time, rather than that kind of latitude. Senator Skoy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And additionally, I would. I'm a little nervous about the fire hall discussion. That's certainly not a regional issue. I'm also a little nervous about the capitalization of a revolving loan fund. I don't think we've ever done that before. So I think those are some issues, Senator Weber, that we should be talking about if this is going to move forward.
Very good. At this point, Madam Chair, Mr. Nasby, from the administrator from the City of Wyndham, I would like him to comment.
Good
Mr.
morning.
Nasby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve Nasby, City Administrator, City of Wyndham. As per the ballot question, we would have a hard number when we went to the November 14 election. We're now going through the process with the architects and the building committee to determine exactly what the cost of the facility would be. Councilmember Jones said we're not going to spend more money than we need to for this project. We're asking for your approval for up to 1%, but when it goes to the ballot, we would then have a firm number on that, whether it's half or three-quarters of a percent. The revolving loan fund, Senator Skoy, was in case there was some additional money, we asked for the opportunity to put it in an RLF. I believe Senator Weber has also a second amendment that if that is something that is going to be problematic, we could drop the RLF portion off of the sales tax bill.
Well,
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and testifiers and Senator Weber. You know, these local option sales taxes sometimes take more than 1 year. There's a long list of these as you look at the agenda today, and
correct.
And just this might need a little work before it's ready to move forward. I'm not proposing we do it today, but I think we need to have some discussion.
Anything further, Senator Dietzig? And Mr. Nasby, Senator Weber, did you have another amendment that you wanted us to consider? Or
second one?
Yeah, that was it.
Okay. Apparently the RLF strike language had not gotten drafted yet. It's something we talked about
correct.
With the staff yesterday.
We can
yesterday,
continue to work on it, Senator Weber. Senator Dietzig.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To one of the testifiers, so are you going to have two different ballot questions, one on the 1% and one on the motor vehicle tax, or are they going to be one?
It'd be one combination of one ballot question, Senator.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Senator Weber, gentlemen, Senate File 1207 is laid over.
Thank you,
as
Madam
amended.
Chair.
Thank you.
We're going to change the schedule around just a little bit, Senator Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
And is Senator Clausen in the room? Then I guess we're not. Senator Scoy, then we'll take up.
We can be last, I don't plan.
Okay. Senator Housley, is she here? Oh, good. Senator Housley brings us Senate File 1329 and Senate Files 1331. We'll start. We can do either one first. What would you prefer, Senator Housley?
Madam Chair, 1329.
1329. We have 1329 in front of us. Senator Housley, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have before you Senate File 1329.
Could you bring the microphone a little bit closer? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Housley. I'm here with Senate File 1329 with the City of Forest Lake. This bill is asking for authority to extend the TIF district for another 10 years. Without that, it will decertify in December of 2015. I have with me the Mayor of Forest Lake, Chris Johnson, and I think I'll have him go first.
Mayor Johnson, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Johnson. I'm the mayor of the City of Forest Lake and also the president of its Economic Development Authority. I have with me our city administrator, Aaron Parrish, and also in the audience here is the president of the Area Chamber of Commerce, Colleen Eddy, who's also here to show support for this bill. We have a regional corridor that is the state highway that goes through Forest Lake and was historically kind of the downtown and the heart of the city. But as things have moved towards the freeway, that corridor has become somewhat forgotten in places and blighted. And so we're looking for an extension of this TIF district to give us some ability to correct that or work towards correcting that. We've had a significant amount of public feedback and input over the last couple years through surveys and a business retention and expansion project that we did with the University of Minnesota and also community conversation series. And the loudest message that we received from our residents was to do something about trying to spur on redevelopment along this corridor. And so the City Council and the Economic Development Authority have identified two sites that we think would be the key starting points or catalysts for that, one on the south end of town and one on the north end of town, that we are looking to have this extended increment be applied directly to. And so we have broad support in the community. We got the Chamber of Commerce has supported this. The county board has unanimously supported this, and so too has the school district board unanimously supported this. And I think that's a reflection of their understanding that this is a regionally significant corridor that needs some attention, that ultimately if we can spur on some redevelopment and make this a more vibrant area of the northern part of Washington County, it'll benefit all those organizations. And so we're asking for the extension of 10 years to this TIF district so that we can use that increment to put towards these specific projects. We were before the Tax Committee for the Senate last year, and one of the pieces of feedback that we received was that we should have a development partner more concretely in place. And so as we come here this year, we do have that. We have a development agreement in place with Pace Development and also with DeSoto, which are the two adjacent property owners that are part of this mall project. And so we have commitments from them to do redevelopment of their sites along with and complementary to the portion that the city's Economic Development Authority has taken on. And so if the committee has questions about any of that or specifics about the projects, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Are there questions for Senator Housley or Mayor Johnson? Okay, then we'll continue with the testimony.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Aaron Parrish, the Forest Lake City Administrator, and I think I would just reemphasize Mayor Johnson's comments and indicate that this is a significant redevelopment opportunity for the community. There are significant redevelopment costs associated with the two particular parcels and areas that we're looking to redevelop, and we just would appreciate any support that the Senate Tax Reform Committee would provide in the consideration of our legislation.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Parrish. Are there questions or comments for Senator Housley on Senate File 1329? Seeing none, we will lay over Senate File 1329.
Thank
the
you.
Next bill is also Senator Housley's, Senate File 1331, also dealing with a TIF district. Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have Senate File 1331, which is requesting a two-year extension of the TIF district for the city of Stillwater. I have Mayor Ken Horisky with me, and I will let him tell the story.
Thank you.
Welcome, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I'm Ken Horisky, the mayor of the city of Stillwater. We are the birthplace of Minnesota. And as a vibrant senior citizen now, in the community, we have our buildings are in need of repair. And in the past, we've used the TIF funds to successfully renovate seven facades to provide low-interest loans to building owners to renovate their buildings on Main Street and throughout throughout the Central Business District. And what we're looking for in this is to extend the TIF district to allow us to have that same flexibility of funds, to use the funds to renovate some of the buildings. In fact, one of the next testifier has a building that goes back to 18-something with walls that, if something's not done, will be falling down shortly. So we're not asking for new funds, new districts. All we're asking for is to reallocate the funds and use them for a similar but slightly different purpose.
Thank you. Are there questions for the mayor? Then we'll go to you, sir, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Gary Ellert, I'm a resident of downtown Stillwater, and I live in the 1800s condo building. The building is a very large building that, again, was built in the 1800s. It's right downtown. We've got a number of residents who are on fixed income. They're retired. Some of them are upside down on their mortgages because of the turn in events. We've been trying to get the building rehabbed for several years. Without this loan, the walls in the building are going to begin to crumble and fall down in the heart of downtown Stillwater. And so I really ask your support that we're able to do this. It will be utilizing Minnesota workers to do the work, and this would be the only way that this project would be able to be funded is if you allow this to happen. So I ask for your support.
And Senator Housley, this is all relative to the jobs TIF that we did, or the Tax Increment Financing Authority we did a couple of years ago, just asking for an extension to be able to include this project. We may be dealing with that in a general with a general law change like your bill does. There have been several others, and we're very curious, and I think we did have some testimony earlier about the number of communities that would be affected and benefited by extending the extending that for another year and or 2 years. So thank you very much for bringing your bill forward, and it you know, keep an eye on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just add one thing. Metro Cities and the League of Minnesota Cities also support both of these bills. So thank you very much for letting us hear it. Thank you.
Senator Housley, thank you for being with us. We will move to Senator Clausen if he's made it into the room. I know he has a testifier who has a schedule issue, so we're jumping around just a little bit. Senator, we're laying over Senate File 1331. Senator Carlson... Clausen brings us Senate File 997. Senator Clausen. Senator Clausen, go ahead.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to meet with you today. Senate File 997 outlines a program whereby individuals who have graduated from a Minnesota post-secondary institution and are paying principal and interest on student loans would qualify for a tax credit based on their individual income level and amount paid in principal and interest on a qualifying student loan. With this proposal, the tax credit amount allowed equals the amount of principal and interest paid during a taxable year on a qualified educational loan up to $4,000. The credit also applies to employers who have made qualified educational loan payments on behalf of an eligible individual employee. There are limitations to the tax credit based on income. For an eligible individual taxpayer filing single or married filing separately, the amount of the credit is reduced by $1 for every $9 that the eligible individual's income exceeds $39,000. And if the eligible individual taxpayer's income exceeds $58,000, the credit is reduced to $1 for every $9 in excess of $58,000. Just a little bit of statistical information. Minnesota college graduates carry the fourth highest average debt in the nation for a four-year degree, and it's just a little under $30,000 per student. The state also has the fifth largest percentage of graduates carrying student loan debt at 71%. And student loan debt has surpassed $1 trillion nationally, with 10% of the borrowers of federally subsidized student loans in default within 2 years of starting repayment. I believe we need to send a message that higher education is a good investment, and as a state, we are willing to help students to guarantee their future and the future of our state. Senate File 997 allows post-secondary graduates to purchase homes, make investments, and purchase more items in the retail market, resulting in increased economic activity. And today we have a number of testifiers in support of Senate File 987. This time I'd like to introduce Mr. Josh Winters, the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group Executive Director. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Clausen. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Josh Winters, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, or MPIRG. MPIRG is a grassroots, student-directed, nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that empowers and trains students and engages the community to take collective action in the public interest statewide. MPIRG works on seven campuses across Minnesota and involves students in every level of the organization. We are present at Augsburg College, St. Catherine University, Hamline University, McAllister College, and the University of Minnesota at Duluth, Morris, and the Twin Cities campus. I'll keep my comments brief, as the testifiers here today are more important to hear from as it relates to the issue of higher education debt, what it means for real Minnesotans, and how the economics of the policy serve to benefit the entire state. I do want to draw your attention to three things. I have some packets here that if someone would be so kind as to share with members of the committee, you greatly appreciate it. In the packets that are going to be passed out, it includes, first I want to draw your attention to, it includes the testimony both from the speakers today, but also those who participated when we presented this bill in front of the Senate Higher Education Committee, as well as those who told their story at the press conference. Second, those stories relate directly to another thing that's in the packet, which is a student debt yearbook, which further details the real stories of higher education debt and the burden that students bear across the state. And then finally, there's an economic analysis of the policy entitled Opportunity Minnesota, an economic analysis, where the cost-benefit analysis of this policy that we call Opportunity Minnesota can be found on pages 12 and 13 specifically. And the applied economist who conducted this analysis, Elton Micharezi, is here today to answer specific questions related to this analysis. With that, Madam Chair and members, I would welcome Kate Dobson to the table to tell her story.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for the witness?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to have a question at some point. I don't know who would answer it. It's the.
Why don't you go ahead now?
Okay, Madam Chair. It's a question with regard to the refundable nature of this credit, and if the intent, it's not exactly clear from the language, is to include the refundable nature for the parents of the student and the spouse of the student, or just for the student, about the refundable nature of the credit. Does anybody have an answer to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I think the intent was just for the student and their spouse, the way it's currently crafted right now. I would say that, you know, we're open to other opportunities to do this or different ways and options. And if, you know, if it's the will of the committee and folks want to, you know, have parents who may make payments on behalf of their students, certainly would be open to that discussion. I assume the senator would be as well.
I just wanted to know what the intent was so we could make sure that the language meets the intent.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I'll just ask counsel, in looking at the revenue estimate, does it assume only the student, or is it, or does it assume other individuals paying on behalf of the student?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, could you repeat the first part of your question?
I'm just asking if Senator Scoy's, House Senator Scoy's question is dealt with in the revenue estimate.
Madam Chair and members, and I believe Ms. McQuay can speak to this in a little further detail. I believe the revenue estimate accounts for the debt incurred on behalf of students and then the credit that an eligible employer would receive. However, the credit for the eligible employer is not refundable, whereas the student credit is.
I think that Senator Scoy's question, Ms. McQuay, is deals with which individuals are defined as eligible, and would it be the parent? Would the parent be eligible to receive it, or is it just the student? Could you just clarify that? Not from the summary, but from the revenue estimate, how they're calculating it.
Madam Chair and members, I believe that according to the calculation, it would include spouses that, because it is household income, I would be less inclined to say that it is extended to parents, but I can certainly, and I believe Ms. Von Mosch is here as well, and maybe we can get that answer for the committee as we go along.
Okay, I think that's a greatly expanded pool of people if it's anyone other than the student. I think that was what Senator Scoy was getting at. So we need to have that clarified. But we'll move on, and perhaps we can hear from Ms. Von Mosch a little bit later. So welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kate Dobson, and I am in my second year at the University of Minnesota, and I'm a board member of MPIRG, also known as the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. Just like many high school students, I graduated with a lot of concerns about how I was going to pay for college. Students are doing all that they can to avoid taking out loans. My personal experience includes working full-time in the summer and two part-time positions during the school year. I'm a community advisor at the University of Minnesota Housing and Residential Life, and which that accounts for most of my room and board costs. I also work at the front desk of my residence hall when I can, so this amounts to about 30 hours of work on top of having a full course load and being an intern with MPIRG. I've been a full-time student for three full semesters now and have taken courses over the summers in order to graduate in 3 years. Even with all of my efforts and my parents' assistance, I'll be graduating with $26,000 of student debt. There are many ways that I could have shaped my college experience, but in order to graduate with less debt, I had to forego some opportunities. Even with graduating a full year early, my debt is very close to the staggering state average, nearing $30,000. This is just one example of the extreme lengths students are taking while earning a higher education. But as my story illustrates, even having done everything I could to reduce the cost, I'm still graduating with a high amount of debt. This is why it is so urgent that we address the issue of higher education debt and pass Opportunity Minnesota or Senate File 997. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Dobson, are there questions or comments? Thank you very much. Senator Clausen, did you have others to
yes,
testify?
Yes, we do, madam.
Yep.
Maybe you could invite them up then.
Great.
Who's next?
Yeah, Madam Chair, next up would be Alora LaValle. And then I don't believe Matt Forstie is here this morning, unfortunately. So,
okay.
Though I do know he testified in Senator Kanan's bill, which is very similar. So,
Ms. LaValle, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Alora LaValle, and I'm a first year at St. Catherine University. Why should we care about Opportunity Minnesota? Not only has the total cost of attending public schools skyrocketed in the past decade, but private college students are also collapsing under the load of tuition and fee increases in Minnesota. The yearly cost to attend St. Catherine University has more than doubled since the year 2000. And if we use the average national rate of tuition increases to make an estimate, and this is even without considering fluctuations in the economy, then in 10 years it is expected to grow by around another $40,000. How can graduates begin to maintain a lifestyle that is remotely close to stable when they cannot escape the crushing weight of their higher education costs? How can they invest in their homes and in their families? How can they undergo experiences that enrich their lives and ultimately make them better assets to their communities? Change my initial question, why should we care about Opportunity Minnesota, to why should we care about Minnesota? And by doing so, I believe that our mission with this bill becomes very clear. The outcome of this bill will reflect how the Minnesota legislature feels about its future. Think about it. We are not only a state of forward thinkers, but of compassionate hearts and iron will. You know that our statewide student body reflects that. We are under more pressure to be exceptional than ever before. We spend days and nights poring over books. We work multiple jobs. We navigate the insane world of social media. We are champion athletes, elite scholars, and relentless artists. We are here, and we chose to invest in our education because we know it matters. Why not invest in us so we can create even more beautiful things for Minnesota? And why not allow higher education to become more accessible for the other 48% of college-qualified youth who cannot currently afford to go? We should care about Opportunity Minnesota because it isn't just about the students. It's about the businesses, the communities, the next generation, and the overall quality of living in our beautiful state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. LaValle. Are there questions or comments for the witness? Senator Dietzig.
I just have a comment more on just the bill. I'd like to thank all the students that worked on this. I know they worked a lot of time. I have the UN Augsburg in my district and actually a St. Kate's Nursing School. And so during the summer, that was a lot of discussion of the cost of college and how they're going to pay for it and how their parents are going to pay for it. And so I know they spent a lot of time, and I know the youth spent a lot of time in Augsburg trying to figure out how we can make this work. And I think I don't know if we'll take part of this bill, part of Senator Cohen's bill, some of the other bills, but I know we are looking at that, and the governor's budget and others are concerned about the cost of higher ed. So we heard, and so I think we are working on it. But thank you for all that you guys have done.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Is there someone else? No?
Madam Chair, yeah. Next up, I'd like to bring Elton Micheresi, PhD and assistant professor in the Department of Applied Economics at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. And again, I would just, if you want to, I know that a lot of the crux of his argument is on page 12 and 13 of the economic analysis, and I even think there was a copy of that, those two particular pages in your handouts, too. So with that.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Elton Micheresi. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Applied Economics at the University of Minnesota. I got my PhD in economics from Virginia Tech in 2007, and I've been a faculty member here at the University of Minnesota since. My primary areas of research are education finance and regional development. So a few years ago, MPIRG approached me to ask me to evaluate the idea that they referred to as Opportunity Minnesota, which is an earlier version of the bill in front of you today. And I mostly agreed because I found the mechanism that they proposed for funding higher education quite innovative, and I thought it was very interesting. So I know typically people testify sort of on behalf of a bill. I want to make sure I state my interest in this has always been strictly academic, so this is my unbiased opinion of this proposal. So to evaluate this, I looked at its likely fiscal impact and its likely social impact. So to start with the fiscal impact, the idea is I view the recipients of the tax credit as two types of people. Those who would have went to college anyway and would have gotten a job anyway and would have pretty much done the same thing that they are doing in the absence or presence of the bill, and we're going to call those the incumbents. And then another group of people who, absent the bill, would have found, or absent the policy, the credit, would have found the debt needed to finance their higher education too high and would have chosen not to pursue a higher education. So these are the marginal students, or the switchers, so to speak. So the benefits from this would come mostly from those who switch, those who change their minds. So on the fiscal side, then, the idea was to try and estimate what would the total revenue loss be because of the tax credit, and then what would the revenue gain be from one person switching from not having a degree to having a degree and living in the state for the average sort of duration of a working life. And then the question is, how many people would you need to switch for the program to be revenue neutral in the long run? So under the original language that was proposed to me, the bill was not capped. So I pretty much assumed that it would wipe out the average debt incurred by the 2011 cohort. So my comments would apply to a representative cohort that resembles one of the recent cohorts, and the idea is everyone knows about the credit before they go to college. They make the decisions based on the existence of this, and I sort of compared a world with and without the credit. So to get at what a degree is worth, I used recent economic research on the causal effect of college degrees on wages, on the causal effect of college degrees on incarcerations, on use of public assistance, and various other outcomes. And then I tried to estimate the fiscal benefits to the state from having an extra college degree as opposed to a person without a college degree. And all those numbers are there, and in also another version of the study that is a little more expanded. So the numbers that I came up with show that for every 100 recipients, 12 would need to be switchers. So if for every 100 people who received the credit, 12 would have not gone to college without it, then the long-term revenue gains would pretty much offset the revenue losses. And so the idea is that if this were entirely financed by debt and it was able to either increase the college graduating class by 12% or in terms of the high school graduating class, that amounts to 2 to 3% increase in graduation rates in college graduation rates among high school graduates. So if the program were able to accomplish that, then if it were entirely financed by debt, the future revenues would be enough to pay for the bond. From a social perspective, the value of a college degree from a social perspective comes primarily because of the additional earnings of the recipients themselves, additional earnings of those around college degree recipients, known as spillover effects, also from lower probability of incarceration, lower probability of using public assistance. There are also multiple other benefits which I did not try to quantify, such as educated people are typically better voters. There are public health benefits to having a higher percentage of people with a college degree in the community. But in terms of sort of the social costs, this is an unusual case because this is a tax credit. So sort of estimating the social cost of a tax credit is not straightforward. So instead, I will speak to it both from a tax viewpoint and from higher education finance mechanism viewpoint. In terms of the latter, if your purpose was strictly to make higher education more accessible, I think the most straightforward way to do that would be a grant program. You could either have a merit-based or a need-based state grant program. I believe we have a merit-based grant program. I'll be the small one. And so, fairly straightforward, it'll get the job done. Well, to do that, you first have to collect the tax, take it through the state, distribute it to the would-be students, some of whom may never graduate. Instead, this particular mechanism only pays if a student is able to graduate and is gainfully employed in the state. So it is not as general or as inclusive as a sort of a general grant program, but it's certainly distributed in a more efficient way, and it's only paid out if students are successful. If you view it from sort of a tax perspective, it is a tax break. Many would argue that tax breaks on young members of the middle class are a good thing in their own right. You know, so opinions certainly differ on that. But this is just not a general tax break. It's a merit-based tax break that goes to college students who are in debt, who would likely use the funds to buy homes and sort of finance their initial expenses as they get out of college. And at the same time, it encourages achievement. It should boost graduation rates and college attendance rates. So I find the mechanism quite interesting. I'm quite frankly surprised it has not been used more widely. To my knowledge, it's only being used in the state of Maine right now.
It's very interesting analysis, Professor. Senator Thompson, then Senator Ortman. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Professor. I believe what's kind of relevant to this, since ultimately the taxpayer would end up then footing the bill for these credits, do you know what other programs are going to be sacrificed in state government to pay for this, or if there will be increased taxes? Have you factored the impact of that in your analysis?
Madam Chair, Senator,
yes,
I do not. I do not know what other programs would be affected or if the tax is, but so the point of the analysis was to provide it without knowledge of what might be cut, and that's why I'm trying to find that break-even point to where if you were to only finance it with debt without touching anything else, what would the program have to accomplish for future revenue gains to be able to wipe out the debt that you are incurring now?
I think, you know, that one of the issues for us is that the scoring of bills like this is not dynamic. It's not looking forward to the possible benefits that offset the upfront costs. We have to look at the current situation that we're faced with to offset the upfront costs rather than future benefits. A lot of us chafe under that kind of analysis, but it is the one that we are, it is the hand we're dealt. Senator Ortman.
I think, Madam Chair, that Senator Thompson had a follow-up question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Thompson.
That's fine, Madam Chair. Thank you. Professor, you must be assuming that the demand for higher education is exceedingly elastic, because I did the calculations quickly, and I don't have the exact numbers, but based on my understanding of how students' loans work, $26,000 that the young lady, I apologize, I forgot her name, is incurred would yield a payment of about $257 a month. And I'll be honest with you, I've got a daughter in college right now. I've got a son a year and a half from college. I don't want their student loan payments waived. I want them to pay a large part of the cost of their education, which is already absorbed by the taxpayer. Now, you, I assume, know something about the value of higher education and how it adds to your income. Do you believe that based on the value of a University of Minnesota bachelor's degree, that it's unreasonable to have what amounts to basically a car payment for your education to pay for it once you get out? Do you think that's an unreasonable number?
Professor?
Madam Chair, Senator, to answer the first question, I did not assume that the demand for a higher education is exceedingly elastic. The numbers that I used, which I think the generally accepted number is that the college degree induces, it has a causal effect of about 40% on a college degree, is very widely accepted. It's based on many recent studies, some of which are cited in the literature of the proposal. And this is an equilibrium result because national data were used to obtain this result. It reflects actual conditions. And so the growth in college degrees required for the program to pay for itself is at about the 3% mark, which is a very small change from the current equilibrium. So I would not expect there would be negative wage consequences from increasing the number of college degrees. The second part of your question is, this is not a welfare program. It's not something that I did not view, at least I did not view it as a program that is trying to establish some sort of equity or anything like that. We, as you mentioned, we already finance higher education, and we do so because there are public benefits to financing higher education. So the question is, how much is enough, and what's a good mechanism? I think given the, so essentially what I've stated today is, given the array of mechanisms that are out there, this seems a particularly nice one. And whether or not we have financed higher education enough at this point, if there's a marginal benefit to going one step further, that would be a matter of opinion. My personal opinion is that yes, there would be.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. Senator Ordman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Professor, I welcome you here. One of the things I love about the Tax Committee is it's psychology, it's a study of sociology, economics, geography. It all plays into the Tax Committee, and that's one of the reasons why I like being here. I admit I haven't taken an economics class since high school. But I am interested, and I'm interested in particular about the conversation that, or the reference that you brought up to the tax burden, and I believe you concluded that the tax burden gets factored in, or would get factored into, a student's decision about whether to go to college or to accept the costs of college, that they would consider that. It would be part of their decision to go to college because there would be a potential tax credit, a refundable tax credit that would offset the costs. Is that what you're saying, Professor?
Senator, yes.
Right, and so then our taxpayers, Professor, are smart enough to assess what is their tax burden in making very big decisions about whether to go to college, whether to invest money, whether to stay in Minnesota or not stay in Minnesota, wouldn't you say?
They are.
All right. And so if this is true about a refundable tax credit for education, it's probably also true, right, about income taxes and corporate taxes, right?
Certainly. I believe all taxes affect decisions.
All right. I agree with that, too, and I just wanted to establish that here. I appreciate the professor helping me to do that because I think what you've said, at least in theory, is you're hoping that at least 12 marginal taxpayers per 100 will switch their plans, change their plans, and go to college and accept the refundable tax credit, and that would neutralize the impact, the financial impact, of the cost of the program. I'm trying to follow you. Am I?
Yes.
All right. So then, would that also then be true? There would be a cost if a taxpayer in an income or corporate tax category left the state of Minnesota or made a decision. You would have to find some other equalizing factor not to lose that revenue too, right?
Professor?
I believe there's a difference. If a firm is making a location decision, from a general social perspective, society is better off if the firm is left alone to decide to locate wherever it finds its suit. And so to the state, from a fiscal perspective, if a firm leaves, then yes, of course, there will be a revenue cost. From a social perspective, I believe that if a firm is left alone to choose their location optimally, there's a social benefit, and if you try to bribe firms not to do that, that's a social cost. This program does not impose a social cost because it lowers taxes, and taxes themselves impose a social cost that economists refer to as a deadweight loss. On the other hand, the incentive that the credit provides is not one to relocate or, you know, do something like that. It's one to obtain a higher education, which is also in its own right a socially beneficial effect. So I would view this as a very, very different type of credit from one that would try to keep a company in its current location or something like that.
Sounds like Madam apples Chair. And oranges.
Yep. Madam Chair, I would agree with the professor on that final point, but I do have a couple.
Senator Ortman, did you want to follow up?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Professor, isn't there an administrative cost to have a system like this? And secondarily, isn't there a far more direct way to attack the problem of the high costs of higher education?
Professor?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, there's an I would assume there is an administrative cost. And I'm not an expert in sort of how different agencies administer their programs. But so let me address both questions at the same time. Yes, there are more direct ways to make higher education more accessible. But I've already argued that I believe if you are trying to marginally increase what is available to students, this might be superior to other ways because it only pays if one is successful. And then in terms of administering a method for distributing funds, I would believe this to be more efficient than, say, the most direct way to finance higher education, which is a grant program. To administer a grant program, you have to tax the revenue, pass it through the Office of Higher Education, and I do know a little bit about how they administer their programs because I work with them quite closely to evaluate some of them. So they would have to then hire the personnel and or expend grant programs in order to administer the grant program. They would have to come up with the eligibility criteria, go through all of that, and then would disseminate it to students, some of whom may never graduate. Instead, the cost of administering a tax credit, I would believe the state is very familiar with how to do that, and the marginal cost of an extra tax credit would be about as low as it gets from an administrative perspective, I would assume, and I do not pretend I have not looked into this. I don't have a very well-informed opinion. It's just sort of a top-of-my-head opinion. So in terms of administering the program, I would believe the cost would be lowest if you did it through a tax credit. Like I said, overall, all things considered, I think it's a very nice marginal improvement on how accessible higher education is.
Madam, just one final comment. I appreciate your analysis, and I agree that it might be comparable to a grant program, but I don't think it's right for Minnesota, given some of the other programs that Senator Thompson was referring to. But also, I think the most direct way to reduce the costs of higher education are to attack the costs of higher education, to reduce tuition rates, to reduce the costs of education, and I think we can do more to go very directly, and there are no costs to doing that. They're built into the savings, and I for one have decided to sit on the higher ed committee for the first time in 10 years for that very reason, to say let's attack this in the most direct method possible. But I appreciate all of your efforts and the analysis that went into this. I'm not sure we're like Maine. We might be in some ways, but for me, I just don't think this program is right, but there are efforts underway to attack the high costs of higher education. Thank you.
Senator Scoy.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and since we're moving to the higher ed committee, I thought I'd throw my two cents in here. I think that the discussion needs to go to the next step beyond just the burden to the individual student and look at ourselves as a state and our competitive nature. And we are either one or two in debt burden that students are carrying as they graduate from college. So that is not good to be number one or two in that category. Now, Senator Claussen is bringing this initiative forward as an effort to attack that. Now, whether it's the most effective way or not is to be debated ongoing, but it certainly is an initiative that would go after it pretty good. Now, the grant program has been talked about, and there's an effort to increase money into that. It's a pretty effective need-based program. This is also a need-based program. It does have an income adjustment to it. And I think it's something that we can consider as we as a state figure out that we should not remain number one or number two in the debt burden that students are carrying, because that's going to hurt our competitiveness in the long run. I think when you talk to the business community, one of their number one issues is to make sure that they have this well-trained, high-quality workforce. And so we have another mechanism now to contemplate as we look to fulfill the workforce needs of the state.
Thank you, Senator Skoy. Senator Thompson, did you have a further question or comment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Professor, I just want to be clear. You indicated that this program would work to reduce taxes, correct?
Yes.
But it's for a certain group of people. In other words, if in fact there are folks that avail themselves of this tax credit, then one of two things or both happens. Other people make up that tax or other state programs are reduced, correct?
Or it is financed by debt that the person themselves pays in the future.
Madam Chair, maybe I didn't make myself clear. What I mean is if somebody claims a $4,000 tax break in any particular year,
Right. Then
in order to make the state budget balance, another taxpayer or group of taxpayers has to either pay that $4,000 or a program has to be reduced by $4,000. So it's a transfer, it's a redistribution of tax responsibility. It's not an overall reduction.
In terms of...
That's right.
Yes, if the state budget needs to remain balanced contemporaneously, there would have to be another source of revenue or a cut.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Senator Thompson, once again, I think a number of proposals that come to us in this way assert a future benefit that offsets the temporary cost that occurs contemporaneously. That's always the case, and we say, well, we're going to do this. I mean, it's the whole basis for tax increment financing. If we don't do this, we're not going to get the benefit in the future.
Yeah.
And we apply that, I think we apply that thinking to any number of proposals that come before us. Some of them we accept and act on, and others we're not able to.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, I appreciate that comment, and certainly I believe that it's best if we can do dynamic analysis of all proposals
I
and score these things. I agree with that. The problem I have here is I have difficulty with some of the assumptions the professor has made. Obviously, we don't want to make this into an economics class because, as they always say, if we could take all the economists in America and lay them end to end, that would be a good thing. But and by the way, I have an economics degree, so I'm not picking on you. But for example, the 12% assumption, I find that hard to believe, that 12% of students would choose not to take up higher education. For example, there are state schools people could go to that the young lady who works as much as she does to get herself through school, like my daughter is frankly doing, could be going to a less expensive school where she wouldn't have to incur any of that debt. Now, I think it's probably a good idea to go to the University of Minnesota because, to Senator Skoy's point, it's a great school. And it may well be that the value of that degree makes it worth incurring some debt to get it. I have trouble with the assumption that we would lose 12% of our students based on the tax consequences of student loans. I just find that hard to believe.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Professor,
Madam Chair, Senator, it's not an assumption. It is a result. It basically states if the program accomplishes this, then it would be revenue neutral. And So that amounts to about a 3% increase on the current graduating class. So just a recent example, Washington, D.C. Recently implemented a program that allowed all D.C. residents to pay in-state tuition in Virginia and Maryland. The average benefit to the student was about $45,000 to $5,000 a year from the program. The increase in the attendance of public colleges was 18%. The increase in people who switched from not going to college at all to going to college was about 5%. So it is not really it is not unbelievable that a program may be able to do that. Other programs have, and it is sort of the break-off number that you would need for this program to be dynamically revenue neutral. Now, if you were to look at it contemporaneously, the best way to save money is to withdraw all public funding from all public colleges and universities. And this year, that would be a huge cost cut. But I would urge one to think about the long-term consequences of doing that.
Senator Ordway?
Madam Chair, I wanted to follow up to confirm. The 12% that you're talking about, that's the 12 out of 100 that you said would need to switch in order to maintain a revenue-neutral environment. And I wanted to ask you, the 12, when you say they're the marginal folks that might go one way or the other, 12 of them have to switch. Are you saying 12 have to decide to go to college and be motivated by the tax credit, the refundable tax credit, in order for this to break even? It's not...
Yes.
12%.
Yep.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the professor, I'm looking at page 6 of the student loan debt. I think you guys handed this out, or did somebody else hand this out?
That's the report that MPRC put together. Depending on the section, the latter half, which is the economic analysis, is the half that was conducted by Elton. The former half, the section largely on student debt, was compiled by MPRG research students and interns, as well as myself.
Madam President, to the testifiers, I mean, on page 6, you know, it shows the consumer price index from 1985 to 2011 grew 114%, and yet college tuition up 498%. So certainly, you know, I understand trying to do programs to make it work for students today. I'm on my fourth college student, so I truly get it. But clearly the cost is an issue, and I don't know if you guys have done research into that as well. If you have, I would love to see the data. What are the cost drivers in education that are dramatically higher than the consumer price index? Where are the numbers that are dramatically up, so that we can maybe more focus on those things as well? Because cost, no matter what we do, we have got to control the costs.
We're going to close off this. Just
that
a second, please. Close off this discussion in about 1 minute to respect the professor's schedule. He needs to leave. Senator Skoy, a brief comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Gazelka, that graph is not a real accurate assessment of the cost of the higher ed. It's the tuition cost. Part of the reason the tuition cost for state facilities has gone up so much is because the state has not been keeping up with the base funding. So when I became a legislator, the state was paying 67% of the cost for a student to attend Minnesota's public university or college, and now it's under 45. All of those dollars have been transferred to tuition costs. So it's not a – you can't look at the tuition cost increase and make the assumption that the total cost is going up because of the shift from state funding to tuition, which the students have to bear, and hence the number one or number two rating that Minnesota has.
Senator Clausen, thank you very much for bringing this bill before us. I think we had a very interesting discussion with your witnesses. Did you want to make one final comment?
I would, Madam Chair. Thank you. You know, there's another group of students that we need to consider in this equation, and that's the students that choose not to graduate because of the cost. They go for 2 years, drop out 3 years. There also are students that graduate in 4 years, graduate in 5 years, graduate in 6 years. If we can get that group of students out into the workforce at an earlier time, they are contributing to the economy as well. comment on Senator Ortman's corporate tax credits. In Minnesota, we have corporate tax credits. We have incentives for companies to move here, stay here, to hire people. And then so I equate it with the same opportunity we're giving students in paying off their tuition. I also agree, because I serve on the higher ed committee with Senator Ortman, that we have to look at the cost of higher education. Right now, a two-year degree is anywhere from $6,500 a year to a two-year degree. For a four-year degree, it's $54,000-plus at the high end in Minnesota. So we do need to look at the grant program. We need to look at how we can keep administrative costs down in our university systems. We look at a number of things. In response to Senator Thompson's $265 analysis car payment, what if they were making a car payment with the money that, instead of making that loan payment back on their tuition, they were making a car payment, buying a new car? What if they were applying that $267 to purchasing a home or to investing in the economy? So I think there's lots of things to look at here. And I think also we'd be open to looking at restructuring this. If there's things that the committee feels that we need to look at, we'd be more than happy to do so. And again, we really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Clausen, gentlemen. And we're going to lay over Senate File 997. Thank you very much for being with
us
today.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is Senate File 1463, Senator Carlson.
You didn't know? You're out of the loop, I'm telling you.
I didn't know.
Senator Carlson.
Goodness.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I have Senate File 1463 to present to you, and it is for a TIF district in the city of Eagan. City of Eagan has been around for in various types of incorporations and abilities for about 150 years, and the city has had, as most of you know, has had a very good reputation for management, for planning, for its balanced mix of jobs, of neighborhoods, of green space. It's just been a wonderful place to live. I've been there my entire life, as has my father and my grandfather. So we've been there a long time, and I've watched this particular property go from farmland to industrial to a major defense contractor, and we're looking at the a natural cycle of going into another opportunity. And with that, I have the mayor of Eagan, Mr. Mike McGuire, and also I have the community development director, Mr. John Hohenstein, who will just be here for answering any specific questions. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the mayor.
Mayor, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, thank you for having me. I'm Mike McGuire. I'm the mayor of the city of Eagan, a proud one at that. Always good to be in front of you, Chair Rest, as well as the rest of the committee. Thank you for the time. The property that we're talking about in this piece of legislation is the former Lockheed Martin site at the corner of Yankee Doodle and Pilot Knob in Eagan. It's the intersection of two very busy county highways. It's a very high-profile site in our community. It has been developed as this site for as long as I have been alive. This site was developed in 1967, and our community was much smaller at this point. That intersection was much smaller. And Lockheed Martin has recently vacated the property, and CSM Corporation has purchased the property. We are in agreement with CSM that we both want to see the absolute best redevelopment of this property that we possibly can. It's a very high-profile intersection in our city, and it's a very important property. CSM property, the property owners, are prepared to come forward with a mixed use of office and retail proposal in order to meet some of the city council's priorities for the area in terms of our comprehensive planning. There are some market challenges to achieving those, and I want to be really clear that the City Council's priorities in terms of this site redevelopment are not lavish by any extent. Our priorities with it are to see it redevelop and come up to date by just connecting a little bit more effectively with the comprehensive plan in the region. We want to try to limit surface parking space, build to a pedestrian scale, ensure that there are bike and pedestrian connections, and that the site is well integrated with the rest of the special area around this very important intersection. In order to achieve that, I think the CSM would tell you that they have to face certain market realities that make it challenging to achieve those goals and update the property that way. So we're looking to be able to partner with CSM so that we can reach our mutual goal, the best possible development there, as well as reaching the public good of the aforementioned concerns that we had. We're hoping to create this partnership. The bill that that Senator Carlson has been so kind as to submit is really quite similarly along the lines, Chair Rest, of a bill that you have in for TIF districts that create jobs. The only difference is that we asked for about a timeline that's about 1 year longer because it's a fairly big project. In order to get all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, we feel like we're going to need that extra year. At this point, we anticipate that the project total in the context of a TIF would produce about $8 million in a gross TIF, which would net about $6 million in terms of the increment. What the uses of that increment would be up to the negotiations and discussion around the overall site development. For example, you know, one of the things that we could do is help to partner with CSM on some structured parking so that we can minimize that surface space, that surface parking, and increase the pedestrian scale and the attractiveness of the overall development. So with that, Mr. John Hohenstein is here from our Economic Development Department. If you have any specific questions, he can answer them. If you have any non-specific questions, I can answer them, and then he can correct me.
Are there any comments or questions for Mayor McGuire, or any questions for the Community Development Director? Senator Skoy?
Well, Madam Chair, I was just thinking, would this, that general law discussion that we've had, and I think your bill is, mm-hmm. would this provision fall within that?
I think this, I think they're asking for an additional year beyond what we've done before. And that, you know, the program ceased in December 31st of 2012. And this is, you know, taking it probably a little bit further than some of us may feel comfortable about. But what we have done and will continue to do is visit with representatives from the city organizations to really find out how many city projects could actually benefit by an extension of 1 year or 2 years, and then make a judgment about what seems to be the best policy going forward. That would be my thought about it.
And Madam Chair, to the mayor or to Senator Carlson, the discussion that we're having is of having a two-year extension for kind of general law. You guys are requesting 3 years. If you'd take a look at your proposal and see if that might work within the two-year time frame, mm-hmm. and we can continue the discussion that we're having.
We'd appreciate that.
By all means, we'll do that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any further discussion of Senate File 1463? Seeing none, Senate File 1463 is laid over. The next bill on the...
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you. The next bill on the agenda is Senator Gazelka's Senate File 32. We have set aside the similar bill from Senator Ingebrigtsen, who I believe is supportive of Senator Gazelka's approach. Senator Gazelka, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
32.
Senate File 32 is fairly straightforward. Just talking to Fiscal about some things that we might need some clarity on, but this bill or forms of this bill have been around for about 8 years. The bill provides a Minnesota income tax exemption for military retirement pay. That's it in a nutshell. The MOAA has for those retiring from military, a state-by-state analysis of what each state provides for those that are retiring and where is the best place to go, and they put out that report
And they look at that and they try to make a decision on where do they want to end up. They've served in the military for 20 years and where would be the best place to be. And there's a growing trend that I think Minnesota is losing out on. And we have 31 states now that exempt all or part of military pay from state income tax, 31 states. And so these folks that I think we should honor for the risk that they've taken for our country are making a choice. They're looking at the options, and they're saying Minnesota is becoming less and less friendly towards those that would retire that way. So as we look at this, my hope is that we will consider moving forward with this. There was a fiscal note that came out that shows the cost of about $21,700,000. And I know we can't do it, but I think it's important that we acknowledge that if we are attracting more military folks, they're paying more property tax on the homes they buy, they're paying sales tax. I mean, I know we don't do it, but I know we need to at least be aware that there clearly is a benefit. And the second thing that we get is these folks, they have 20 years of expertise in a variety of things. The vast majority of them are coming back, and they have a second career, and they come to Minnesota with that career and with that expertise, and so they add tremendous value to Minnesota. What I would say is they're not a burden to the state. They're a blessing to the state. You look at the benefits that are provided for their health care. It's not from the state. Those are federal. And so there's just, to me, it's a win-win-win for Minnesota. And so, Madam Chair, members, I hope you'll take a look, but I do have three testifiers that are, I think, can speak more eloquently than I can about this. And so we've got Ralph Donais, Jerry Kaiser, and Doc Severson here.
Who's going first?
Madam Chair, my name is Ralph Donais. I'm the chairman of United Veterans Legislative Council.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, ma'am. I've spoken to you before, and whenever we get in here, it immediately goes back to why do we need to give these veterans a break? It's not about giving me a break. It's about bringing some of the highest qualified men and women employees in the United States back to Minnesota. I'm looking at down the road if I can ever get my great-grandchildren back into the state because their parents are in the military and they're refusing to move back here. I would love to make sure that we have the finances to give those kids a good education. The document that the senator referred to lists 11 items that a retiree would look at or a second career person would look at to give them incentive to move to one or the other of the states. Of those 11 items, Minnesota only has two yeses. The other nine are like a black mark against Minnesota. And I think it's time that we get those black marks moved away. In 2011, according to the DOD actuary, and I'd given you that information last time I was here, we only have about 16,900 that are actually receiving their paychecks. We have 2,000 reserve and guard folks that do not get to withdraw their retirement until they reach age 65. I don't know the exact age of all of those folks to tell when that money might kick in as far as not going into our tax rolls. But I have never, ever come across since 1994 when I retired of a military person that came back to the state who didn't have a job and whose spouse also didn't work. So you're talking about coaxing these people to come back to get two taxpayers instead of just one. And I think that we're losing the whole object of this bill. It's not about giving me a break. I'm over age 65, and over 52% of the retirees are over age 65 already. We've only increased 250 people a year, approximately, for the last 11 years. We've only increased 0.7%. And so when they project these costs down the road of $25 million in 2017, we can always project how much it's going to cost, but you never, ever see anything in the 12 years I've been down here lobbying of how much money more money that's going to bring to the state. We've never, ever been able to talk about that because we're always told you can't mention the money that they might earn in the state. Well, if you can mention the money that they're going to take away, why can't we mention that money that they're going to earn? And again, I don't know of anybody that retired, came back, and went to work for McDonald's. You know, it just doesn't happen. So along with our education, our medical, all of that stuff is taken care of. And Senator Ortman has blessed us with bills in the past. And I just think it's time that Minnesota becomes one of the 23 states in the United States that says, hey, we want these second career people to come back to Minnesota. Thank you, madam.
Thank you very much, Mr. Denaes. Would you like to continue if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm the vice chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council. I'm also the co-chairman of the Military Action Group. That's a group of legislators, House and Senate, that we put together kind of a workshop of a kind of legislative things that we're going to be talking about. And I am a disabled Vietnam combat veteran. I am not a retiree. And I do get a pension from the federal for my combat injuries, and that's not counted in the dollars that bring in back into the state of Minnesota as far as the pension that would come in. I believe as far as pensions paid in the state of Minnesota, it's $353 million. In addition to that, all the other monies that come in for the schooling and the GI Bill and the benefits for disabilities, it totals almost $1 billion. And so that's not chump change in the state of Minnesota. We're trying to work for a way that we can bring these, as Ralph, Chairman Ralph said, the highly educated senior NCOs and officers back into the state of Minnesota. Now, the military is cutting back. Last year, they cut out 129,000 people. And the current process is another 200,000. Now, a lot of those are not 20-year retirees, but the objective would be to bring them back that want to. They're highly motivated, entrepreneur attitudes, and they have the skills and the management skills that the state of Minnesota needs and companies are looking for. My friends who are in the business community, that's what I concentrate on. Unfortunately, they sometimes move their business over to Wisconsin because it's a better deal for them. And I'd just like to have a way for us to get ahead with that. My son-in-law and daughter are in the military. They're Marines. And he's going to be going to work for Delta Airlines as a pilot. But he says, well, you know, I'm thinking about moving back to Wisconsin and then commuting out of Minneapolis-St. Paul. So I'd like to have them move to Minnesota. And not that I couldn't go see my grandson more often, but I don't want them living in Hudson or Prescott or New Richmond. I'd like to have them met here in the Twin Cities.
Thank you very much.
That's my take on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Severson, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Hear your testimony.
Dan Severson, former Navy, former state legislator. And we've had this bill before the legislature for about 8 years. So there's a lot of information that's gone forward, and a lot of this is just to kind of refresh the members. But I want to talk a little bit just about some of the people that testified earlier here, and they talked about college students who are looking to gain an education that creates a value added to Minnesota. And here we have a group of people. I spent 3 years in Washington, D.C. working on promotions, boards, policies, and plans. And the military has a structure in which they take the best and they promote them to management leadership. And so those that don't cut the grade end up not retiring. They end up getting out before a 20-year retirement. So what we're talking about is a group of people who have been in competition and who have risen to the top in their profession, and those professions range across the board from logistics to battle tactics to the whole nine yards. These individuals are the cream of the crop. Now, when these individuals get out, they don't get out at 65 or 75 years old. They get out, and they still have probably 20 to 30 years to contribute to society. They're going for a second career. So they're at the top of their game, and they're getting out and bringing significant skills. There are three states currently that exempt completely military retired pay. Wisconsin is one of those. In 2001, Wisconsin said, we're going after this talent. And in 2001, Wisconsin brought in about $800,000 more per year in retirement pay from Defense Finance and Accounting Services than Minnesota. Now that number is up to $42 million and climbing. And when we had people come in front of this committee from CEO corporations, they said, these are the people that we want to hire. If we can give them this incentive, we can bring that talent to Minnesota. That didn't happen. They moved out of state. There were people testifying here who were ready to make that decision, and after it was shot down in the legislature, they moved out of state. We are saying no to a talent pool that is exceptional. And we have the opportunity here to create jobs because they're innovators, because they're experts in their field, but we also have the opportunity to do something positive for Minnesota in terms of bringing talent that has already been through the educational system. They're bringing spouses, has been testified here. They're going to buy houses. They're going to be committed to the communities. They have a very, very high volunteer rate. So this is a course and a class of citizens that Minnesota ought to really be taking a hard look at in terms of intellectual property and saying we want open arms for these warriors. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you very much, Mr. Severson. Senator Gazelka, do you have anything further?
Madam Chair, can Mr. Donaes make one more comment?
Of course. Mr. Donaes.
Madam Chair, Monday I had a kind of a surprise, but it was a sad surprise, and that a friend of mine that I hadn't seen in a couple months showed up in my driveway. And I said, Dick, it's really great to see you. What's going on? He said, I just come to let you know that I'm no longer a resident of Minnesota. I've moved to Florida. And I, being the president of a retired enlisted association in Minnesota for many years, I have had that statement made to me way too many times. And it's just a shame that I have to lose my friends because of our taxes. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Donaes. Senator Gazelka, anything further?
Madam Chair.
Comment? Oh, Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have been an ardent supporter of this proposal for a long time. But two things that I would tell you that have changed in my course of being a supporter that have made me an even stronger supporter of this proposal. 2 years ago, I was invited to Chicago through the National Conference of State Legislators. And we got to meet with the folks from the Federal Reserve out of Chicago. And that was back in 2010 when we were all in the very deepest trough of the economic recession. And they told us that one of the best ways we could improve our economy and do economic development would be exactly this, to encourage military folks to come back to Minnesota. This would be the best economic development program we could invest in because these are the folks that will come back and be CEOs. They'll head up the research and development departments. This is the talent that our Minnesota businesses are saying we need in Minnesota in order to take us to the next level and become competitive. And so those other states were there too. Wisconsin was there, and representatives from Nebraska and Iowa and North and South Dakota. And I think they're making efforts to do this. We want to compete not just with them, but nationally for this talent. And then the second thing that happened, my son Raymond, I'm so proud of him. He is a private first class, and he is in Monterey right now. And he was recruited by the Army to spend 18 months immersed in Chinese training, language and culture, and then go to cryptology training in Texas. And so forget the fact that he's my son for just a moment. I will never, but, you know, just for a moment, forget the fact. This is a Minnesota student, a kid who grew up here, graduated from Chaska High School, went to St. Thomas for a couple of years, got recruited from the university or from the Army, is going to be trained in Chinese, will be trained in cryptology, will serve in the military for 6 years. Now, I want him back because I'm his mother. But don't we want him back in Minnesota to bring all those talents and all that training into our business community when he's done, whether it's in 6 years or 10 years with even more training or he goes on to become an officer? Don't we want those people back in Minnesota to generate growth in our economy? I say absolutely yes. And I cannot figure out, since I've promoted this bill as a member of the minority and as the majority and back in the minority, why on earth can we not get this done? This should be one of our very highest priorities. This one's a no-brainer. And I think everybody at this table should step up and say, add this into the omnibus bill. It's a priority.
Senator Scoife.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ortman, until your child or mine serves 20 years, this won't have any impact on them. But, Senator Gazelka, you did mention this in your comments, and is the cost of this. And, you know, we're going to raise some taxes around here this year to fill the deficit in the state budget. And then after that, we now have this list of credits that people are advocating for, from higher ed to this. And I'll tell you, you know, unless we're going to be supportive of the revenue to pay for these things, they're very hard. I would like to think, Senator Gazelka, that maybe we'll take a look at the two credits that the state currently has. Maybe there's some incremental improvements that we can make in those and try to do this on an incremental basis. It's just that I'm trying to kind of tell everybody that, you know, it's going to be hard this year because we do have a deficit that we have to solve first.
Senator Gazelka.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoife, too. I'm talking to fiscal. I think that number could go down quite a bit, you know, depending on how we clarified it as far as 20 years or some of those things. And so I just think we should be moving forward for many of the reasons why I've been brought out.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Gazelka, for bringing the bill and the issue once again to our attention. And thank you, gentlemen, for your service. The next bill on the agenda is Senate File 1392. Senator Scoife. And we're going to lay over Senate File 32. Senator Scoife.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here with Senate File 1392. It's a issue that the Minnesota cities and counties have been working with for the last year. In 2011, there was a change. Just a brief little bit of history. We had a moratorium on local option sales taxes, and that was set to expire, and it changed into a moratorium on local governments expending any money on their efforts to raise revenues to improve their community. And this is an initiative to try to make changes to that so that communities would be able to educate their constituents about the tax proposals that they're coming forward with. As you know, many of these elected officials are not being compensated very much for their work. It truly is public service. And I think if they are incurring a few expenses in the education of their public, it would be appropriate that we would be supportive of some amount of expenditures for that informational purpose. I am here with Mr. Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities, and he will provide much more detail and explanation.
Senator Mr. Carlson. Thank you, Senator Scoife.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you to Senator Scoife for introducing this bill. He highlighted the history of this change in state law. It did occur in 2011, where the moratorium on new sales taxes was converted into a moratorium on expenditure of public funds for anything except for the conducting a referendum. And that created some questions from our city attorney community asking, well, what does that really mean? And if we can only expend public funds for the referendum, does that limit our ability to even educate and communicate with the public about these local sales tax proposals? There's a lot of case law that does surround this issue. We do have direction from the state auditor that gives us a lot of direction about the difference between advocacy and education. I do have a copy of a memo from the state auditor that I could share with the committee if the chair would like. But really, in this bill, we're not eliminating the line that talks about advertising or promotion of a local sales tax. We're really adding to the authorization to say that cities or counties essentially could educate the public by sharing with the public the information that has to be included in the local resolution supporting the sales tax and other information about the impact of the local sales tax on local purchases and the impact of the sales tax to fund a local project. Again, we do actually, we modeled some of this language after some of the language in a Supreme Court decision, a recent decision, a 2012 decision involving the St. Louis County School District. And in that decision, Justice Paul Anderson actually had a fairly eloquent concurrence suggesting that we should not limit or restrict the ability of school districts in this case to educate the public on what they're asking for. So we really think this would clarify the law. It doesn't prohibit, I'm sorry, it doesn't take away the prohibition on advertising and advocacy, but it's trying to carve out educational expenses that could be employed by local governments to educate the public. With that, Madam Chair, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Skoy, I have a suggestion for a slight amendment. I don't believe a fact is anything other than objective by its definition, and I would move to strike on lines 2-1 and 2-3 the words objective. And so the sentence would read, provide facts and data. Senator Skoy, is that agreeable?
It's agreeable to me.
We have the rest motion to amend. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Skoy?
You did that on line 2.1 and 2.3?
That's correct.
And I just wanted to clarify, I believe while there was some discussion about schools, this bill deals with cities and counties only.
Cities and counties only. Is there further discussion of Senate file 1392? Seeing none, Senate file 1392 is amended as laid over. Our last bill on the agenda is Senate file 1434, waiting for Senator Cohen to come in. As we're doing that, he is on his way, we've been told. We thought maybe we could just give a little bit of information about how we're going to proceed. We are not meeting tomorrow. We are meeting in the full committee on Monday. We have a number of bills to get through there. On Tuesday, we'll be meeting in the division, taking up a number, once again, you may be seated, that's fine, taking up a number of sales tax items. The full committee will meet on Wednesday again, and on Thursday, we hope to present the committee with a proposed division report on tax reform initiatives that we've been dealing with primarily in the division to have action on that report the following Tuesday. So that's our schedule. Anybody have any questions, comments, a joke? Seen any good movies lately? Senator Cohen brings us Senate file 1434. Senator Cohen.
So, thank you. Sorry about it.
That's quite all right.
Committee, I apologize. The request is for the division to consider looking at a tax credit relative to Film Production Minnesota. Members, I've been involved with the film board for a number of years, and kind of glanced around the table. Madam Chair, you were in the legislature in the 1990s, which was kind of the golden era of film production in Minnesota. Minnesota was the fourth largest production market in the country, L.A., New York, Chicago, and Minnesota. And the purpose, so members might recall the variety of movies that were made then when we actually had a strong production market. The purpose of this is not art. It's not for fun. It's for economic development. Over the years, I've had jurisdiction over the economic development agencies when I was chair of the State Department's division, and at some point did a fairly exhaustive study of what worked, what didn't work. And my conclusion was, and not just on my own, but with some folks at that point who had some significant background with economic development, is that a lot of what we do with economic development is shifting money around. That if we offer credits or incentives or whatever for the purpose of creation of new jobs, that quite often those monies might have been available anyways within a particular corporate structure. The film board was a way, other than a bonding bill, to produce jobs tomorrow morning, in essence. That in the 1990s in particular, we had an industry that employed on a full-time basis approximately 5,000 people, give or take, half of which were union jobs. And it was a significant part of the Minnesota economy. What's happened more recently is that everything has kind of fallen by the wayside, the reason being that at the end of the 1990s, into the first part of that decade, film incentives came into play as a means to entice production companies to a particular state. Obviously, with the budget problems we had, although we had one of the original film incentives, but with the budget problems we had, we were unable to be competitive. The other thing that happened at that time was the Canadian exchange rate became so significantly favorable to Canada, a lot of the domestic work went to Canada. As that changed and became more equitable, other states had come into the production efforts. Minnesota has fallen way behind. We still have some significant advantages over other states. We have a secondary acting pool, which is arguably, other than Chicago and New York, second to none. We have, obviously, in the context of the Twin Cities in particular, you have a very accessible area. You can be doing something in the middle of Minneapolis and be 20 minutes away from a rural or a lake setting. So you have an accessibility that doesn't exist elsewhere. Obviously, we've got winter. What we don't have is the ability to be competitive with other states. This year, we're trying to make an effort to secure Minnesota's ranking again. It would take some time before we got back to where we were in the 1990s, but to secure Minnesota being competitive again. With all the talk about job creation, with what's being proposed, I would argue the opportunity to recreate the film board in a competitive way would be the way you could guarantee the creation of significant new jobs in the state of Minnesota, not jobs that would come in online in 10 years, not jobs that would show up in a few years, jobs that would show up within the year. You couple that with the so-called spinoff of economic development, separate from the direct tax dollars realized back to the state, and you have something of significance that would compare, and I would argue outstrip anything else that's being considered relative to economic development, with the possible exception of a bonding bill. So that's to set the stage, Madam Chair and members. This proposal proposes a tax credit. Now, there is, to be fair, on a parallel basis, a general fund request as well, which I think Senator Tomasoni is going to do something with in his division. But we wanted the opportunity to present the other alternative, which is something that actually has had a great deal of success in other states in terms of utilization of a tax credit. And we have the folks here who have done this. I'll ask them to offer testimony more directly. Madam Chair, Lucinda Winter, who's the director of the Film Board. I think we have Kelly Pratt, Ms. Pratt, and Ricky Woolley. Ms. Woolley was involved with the origin of the Film Board. And just if you'll allow me a quick anecdote, Madam Chair, I'll try to do it very quickly. As I understand the old history, this predates myself, Judith Guest, the author of Ordinary People, which won the Pulitzer Prize, moved to Minnesota. She had come from Detroit. And Ms. Guest had optioned her book to Robert Redford. He flew to Minneapolis. They drove around. She was new in town. They had no idea who to talk to. They filmed the movie outside of Chicago. Within a year or so of that, Ms. Guest, Ms. Welly, and John Stout sat down and put together the concept of the film board, which was then a fairly new concept around the country. And when Governor Perpich came back into office, that was one of his economic development proposals. So Ms. Welly was involved with that. Kelly Pratt, Ms. Pratt, was a staff person at the film board in the golden era in the 1990s, was the assistant to Randy Abmasek. And assisting them was the gentleman to my right, your left, Andrew Peterson, who left town, who has been a very talented director and producer in his own right, has come back to town, is now head of Independent Film Project North. So we have folks who have been involved with this, can speak to Minnesota on a competitive basis, why this proposal would be of benefit. And you've heard enough from me, and I'll present it to the folks to testify.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Who would like to start? If you would identify yourself, please, for the committee and for the record, and keep the microphone close, if you would, for the tape. Thank
you.
Good
morning. Good morning. I'm Lucinda Winter. I am currently the executive director at Minnesota Film and TV. And I'll keep my remarks really brief because I'd like you to hear from the testifiers. And I will only further Senator Cohen's tee up by asking you to, if you've received this.
Yes, we have. It's very interesting. Thank you.
This is a snapshot of our competition, right, domestically, and on the back, full details. And I think it just paints the picture of the challenges we face, because Minnesota is just not in the room anymore when it comes to attracting film and television and commercial production to our state. And we want to return to where we were in the 90s and more. So it's a growing industry. It's a large export for the U.S., and we want to be back in the game. So I'm going to turn it over now to the other testifiers.
Okay, who would like to go next? If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I am Kelly Pratt. I spent 10 years from 87 to 97 as the Director of Production for the Minnesota Film and Television Board. That meant that I was the first...
See, somebody's phone is too close.
I was the first line of contact with Hollywood or whichever filmmaker was calling. So I was the one who rode around in vans with the grumpy old men people and so on back for at least 10 years. After that, I moved up north. I lived in Detroit Lakes for the last 15 years, from 97 until recently, and I continued to work with the film board until 2005. I published the resource guide, more than 1,000 people and businesses in that guide, of people and businesses that worked in the film and television industry. I also came back and commuted for a while Lucinda was on the board and helped manage the board. So I've had a long history. When I moved back, what I kept hearing was, so-and-so has moved to New Mexico. This person has moved to Atlanta. And I continually heard that we had started to lose a lot of our crew people, that there weren't movies coming here. I heard about Gran Torino, which had scouted here, was written for here, but decided to shoot elsewhere because we didn't have an incentive. And so I've been volunteering since I got back with some folks, these guys and some crew people that are behind me, to research and help our industry kind of get back to fourth from 44th. When I started at the film board, I got a phone call from a director one day. We'd been scouting for a television movie. And she said, I just wanted to tell you that we're not going to Minneapolis. We're going to Minnesota instead. And that was how off the radar Minnesota was in the early, actually that was 1988. And we built it, Randy Adamsick and I and our staff, Andrew and all the volunteers, built it to fourth in the country for the busiest location for filmmaking. And if you think of an entire corporation like 3M getting out of their buildings and moving into a neighborhood or into a town and then spending money for lunch, for coffee, for all of those things, wherever they happen to go, that's what the film industry is. It's hard for those of us in it to talk about it because you guys can't see a big building. It's sort of invisible, but they spend a lot of money wherever they go. We used to say, take only pictures, leave only footsteps. And I will turn it over to Ricky because she has a couple of anecdotes, I think, about some location filming in northern Minnesota. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Ricky McManus, and I am the director of the Upper Minnesota Film Office. And I was back here in the heyday, and I was a casting director. And I remember the days when we had I would have three different crews working on three different movies at the same time. That was fun. And besides that, we had our regular commercial business. Things were hopping back then. And you know the most exciting part of it was the job creation that developed because of it. It is a very clean economic impact that happens when a film comes into your area, because what they do is they come, they shoot their movie, they don't ask for us to build roads or schools, they clean up after themselves, leaving nothing but money behind. How wonderful is that? Ask the people in Beaver Bay that had the Beaver Bay hardware store. In one day, people from the Good Sun came in and spent $33,000 in a winter economy in Little Beaver Bay. They were very excited. Talk about Paul from Paul's Meat Market in Eveleth when we were shooting North Country. He said, because of North Country, I made it through the winter. It was iffy if he would have otherwise. But he did very well financially, and he fed a lot of people in that movie crew. Look at the Natural Harvest. It's the Whole Foods type of company up in Virginia, where they had a hard time convincing people in the Iron Range to come and eat organic foods. It was hard to educate everybody until everyone went there because that's where the stars were. And as they were there, they got educated. And now, instead of when the movie moved out and you see a little bit of a downtick, it was steady. Steady business, because now everyone is coming and purchasing at Natural Harvest. You know, we were number four. The infrastructure is still here. We can be number four again. And I am so excited to see that happen. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Andrew Peterson. I'm currently the Executive Director of IFP Minnesota. Prior to that, I was Vice President of Production for an independent finance and production company based here in Minnesota, where my primary job was to analyze state incentives and also incentives in Canada and other countries. I started off as an intern. Became a location manager, then became a producer, and have now been involved in productions that have had budgets over between 20 and 30 million. Very little of that was spent in Minnesota. 2 points there is that my career wouldn't have happened if we didn't have this industry here in the 90s. I've had five interns at Works, my past company, all brilliant, bright people who came out of one of the great programs here that educate people on how to be a film professional. They've all moved. They've all left the state. We're losing creative talent. We're losing money. We're losing our place in the industry. As Ricky pointed out, we were fourth, and there was a reason we were fourth. We have so many things people want to shoot here. One of my first jobs was on a film called Beautiful Girls, which was set in Massachusetts. They shot that movie here because they didn't want to shoot in Massachusetts. We were fourth, Massachusetts was 40th. Now it's flipped. Massachusetts is fourth, and we're last. They made over $1 billion in film income in the last 5 years. And if we were to come up, we would take that job. We would take those jobs back. We absolutely would. Our unions are people top to bottom. People love working with our unions. They love working with our crews. We have an infrastructure here of equipment and diversity of locations and ease of movement. When a project comes here, they come back. I worked with 20th Century Fox several times, with New Line Cinema several times. When they come here, they come back. It's very hard to give a guarantee. I feel really comfortable giving a guarantee that if we had a competitive tax incentive, we would be number four again. We would rise to the top, and hundreds of millions of dollars would eventually find their way into the state, and we would be up there in the leaderboard. Now, we're here to talk about incentives. There are 40 other states and the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico that have production incentives or tax incentives. The great majority of those are refundable or transferable tax credits. And of the most successful states, they're all either a refundable or a transferable tax credit. Part of the reason is because so much revenue is coming into the state that it's harder to give a cash to be dealing with cash. So they're dealing with it in that way, and there's a longer term for it to be to be realized and returned. It can be when we shot in Puerto Rico, which has a 40% tax credit. It took over a year, and then you lose a little bit on it, but you get about 9 cents on the dollar for it coming back, but everybody calculates that in. The bottom line is I could talk about a lot of the states that are really successful, but one of the most exciting possibilities to be competitive again and to be number four again is what's happening in TV right now, TV series, whether it's Salt Lake City, Detroit, Boston, Williamette, and Raleigh, North Carolina, Boston. When you bring a TV series into town, you have long-term commitments from the projects. They're buying houses. Their bricks and mortar companies are being built. Sound stages are being built to support them. Panavision and other industry support area business in California open offices in the state. This isn't conjecture. It's happened in every single state that has a competitive tax incentive and brings in a TV series. Fargo is being talked about as being a TV series now with the Coen brothers executive producing it. Other series have been written for here but shot elsewhere. We are in a position to have this here, and that's really where the excitement comes, where it kicks up into a higher gear, because there's excitement across the board when you can bring in hundreds of millions of dollars. I always say the film industry is an ATM, and it's true. It's not the Mall of America or a stadium. The industry comes to town and does nothing but spend money, and across the board, everybody benefits. When we shot Thin Ice in Hopkins, we kept restaurants open through the winter. That was one of the worst economic times there were here, and we were there every day. Our crew has drivers and there's four or five unions that we work with. We play nice with everybody, and everybody plays nice with us, and it's really it's a win-win situation across the board. Those are basic. I figure I could talk forever, but maybe there should be some question time if you have.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Coen or the testifiers? Senator Dietzig.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then we do need to be mindful of the time.
I have a question on page, and it's actually on language of the bill. Line 311, any and all portion of tax credits issued may be transferred, sold, or assigned. Is this to any corporation, or is this as part of I'm producer X or I'm the film company X, and I'm now going to, transfer this to somebody else to do the project and be another, or is it a tax incentive for them to sell to any other entity in Minnesota?
Madam Chair and members, yes, it's the transferable tax credit is available for, is sold to another corporation in need, that would be in need of purchasing credit. So, yes.
Anything else? Then thank you very much, Senator Coen, and we will lay over Senate File 1434.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And there being no further business before the division, we stand adjourned.